Come thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. Streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise. Teach me some melodious sonnet, sung by flaming tongues above. Praise the mount, I'm fixed upon it, mount of thy redeeming love. I would not advise singing in public. It's just not worldly wise. It's a waitress obliged to serenade you and your marshmallow sauce sweet potato fries with happy birthday to you. She seems embarrassed, almost ashamed. It may violate the nature of song itself. It might as well be spoken. But when God speaks, God weeps for you and me. When God speaks, God shouts life into being. When God speaks, God weeps for you and me. And God's shout, it never fails, so keep singing. There is that moment when some karaoke'd world steps naked into broad daylight. Through a combination of spin and maybe sin, the happy birthday stands bold and inviting, so the whole room starts chanting in tune and unison, and we all want this, don't we? We all want the anti-death to arrest sobriety. We all want pleasure to surprise the day. But it's still a little weird, transgressive almost, to sing in public. Our songs, they don't look us in the eye anymore. Our celebrations, they hide. But when God speaks, God weeps for you and me. When God speaks, God shouts life into being. When God speaks, God weeps for you and me. And God's shout, it never fails, so keep singing. The songs of the hills are shameless, blameless, untamed, though the same again and again and again. But we just want a friend, someone who might help us forget that there's a debt that the hills want yet. But the snow can't cover the cold. The hills' voice fades the day we die. They can say hello, but not goodbye. The world screams life, then hastens on to its funeral song. When God speaks, God weeps for you and me. When God speaks, God shouts life into being. When God speaks, God weeps for you and me. And God's shout, it never fails, so keep singing. Even homes gathered to sing happy birthday can't evade the way our songs are jaded. Dad sings off key to break the fall while mom tries to harmonize, and brother makes flatulence between lines, and sister doesn't sing at all. See how he loved him? He gave him a friend. See how he loved him? But that wasn't the end. Take a deep breath. Imagine the heavy stench of ferment flesh, then in a flash made fresh, because when God speaks, God weeps for you and me. When God speaks, God shouts life into being. When God speaks, God weeps for you and me. And God's shout, it never fails, so keep singing. When God speaks, God weeps for you and me. When God speaks, God shouts life into being. When God speaks, God weeps for you and me. And God's shout, it never fails, so keep singing. We think that we need to see, but Lazarus is you. Lazarus is me. Our songs cower before the emptiness inside. Our sickness lies, you will not surely die. Our sisters cry, he would have survived, but our hopes only revive, because when God speaks, God weeps for you and me. When God speaks, God shouts life into being. When God speaks, God weeps for you and me. And God shout, it never fails, so keep singing. There is a song thrumming through human veins. You can see it's recalled in a newborn babe. And even this cadence may seem cliche, but there's a reason rhyming in the nursery lays. Privacy is broken in its earthly ways, but where new life is spoken, it must be chosen to stay. For when God speaks, God weeps for you and me. When God speaks, God shouts life into being. When God speaks, God weeps for you and me. And God's shout, it never fails. So keep singing. So keep singing, child. Sing happy. Sing free. So keep singing, child, in major keys, unashamedly. So keep singing, child. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I'm constrained to be. Let thy goodness like a fetter bind my wandering heart to thee. Father, thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for your word. Strike anything from the record that is not of you. Holy Spirit, come. Nothing good can happen today or any day in nature, in the church, in your word, anywhere without you. So come right now, please. I need you so much. We need you so much. Amen. The glory of God is the decisive power of godliness. The glory of God, as opposed to the love of God primarily, is the essential, unique destination of the power of godliness. You see, many of us think of God not primarily as someone to look at. Many of us think of God as someone who likes to look at us. Many of us see God as a mirror. And we like that. We like mirrors. And we don't realize that it is in fact we who image God. We don't look at God so that we can see ourselves and be pleased. God looks at us so he can see himself and be pleased. The word for glory in the Old Testament is kavod, heaviness, weight. The glory of God is something that sets heavy on your chest. The glory of God in the New Testament is the word doxa, praise, illumination, shininess, bling. It's that thing that catches your eye when it walks into the room. Now, in our culture, we love this, 1 John, God is love. But what does that mean? You know what that means? It means the Trinity. And the Trinity is this. There is the Father. He exists in eternal substance of who he is. He is permanent and constant and passionate. And then there is the Son, who is the essence of God made visible. And he looks at that and he says, oh, that is so good. That's what it means that God is love. And he looks and they're high-fiving each other and they're giving each other back rubs like me and Jim are going to do later. And that creates the third person of the Trinity. God is love does not mean that God makes much of you or me. It means that he makes much of himself. And he invites us into that. He says, come look. Come look at me. Come make much of me like I make much of me. I was told in preaching class that you got to start strong. So I'll take it down here for a little bit. Why talk about this? I'm going to do a little bit of apologetics, right? I don't believe that apologetics is decisive, but it's important. And even you guys are like, man, this guy's really serious. He needs to defend that. John Piper says that this is why we should talk about this. John Piper, who, if you're a theologian of my generation, you just jack stuff from John Piper all the time. So, you know, everybody else is doing it. He says this, preachers can say dozens of true and wonderful things about the gospel and not lead people to where the gospel is leading. That's why we talk about this. Because I know you have people that you love. You love them. And maybe your relationship started by praying with them on a regular basis. Sharing accountability. Sharing the word. And what's going to give you the strength to love God when they walk away? And you have to look back on that relationship and say, who knows what that meant? Who knows if it was even real? Where are you going to get the strength to do that? Where are you going to get the strength to understand, to have categories for the fact that ministries and people and InterVarsity and churches and families can say dozens of true and wonderful things about the gospel and not lead people where the gospel is leading? What do I mean by that? Who cares that Jesus died for you if you don't get God? That's what I mean by that. Who cares that Jesus died for you? The reason that's good news is because it removes barriers between you and God. It unblinds you. It gives you sight. That's why it's good news. How do I know this? Well, I'm going to start with my experience. I came to church because my mom started coming to church. And I was like, this is weird. I mean, you guys aren't weird. You guys are cool. But I was weird and awkward and uncomfortable. So I was going to Washington High School, and I was a pretty cool guy. I liked being cool. I liked being popular. And over time, I started coming to the youth group here. And I'll tell you what I liked about the youth group at first, and for a long time, really, was that I was liked at the youth group. It was another place for me. It's like I was on the other side of town. It's like a whole new group of people to like be popular with. Yeah. And was the youth ministry doing something wrong? No. In fact, this is a way above average youth ministry in terms of like clarity and, but I was not there. In fact, I went to Bible camp. I went to Spring Valley. I loved it. You know why? Because I got a best friend and a girlfriend in 1 week. And they had this little bonfire where you like come up and you confess your stuff. And I got some guilt relief up out of that too. You know what I'm saying? Didn't really like, I mean, it did actually make some changes in my life, you know, but I got some guilt relief out of that. And actually, this is really funny. I added this to the notes this morning while I was drinking coffee. This belt. I got this belt at Spring Valley Bible Camp. One of my buddies there who was in the cabin with me, and we were like really, you know, when you're really in it with a friendship, you just start giving each other stuff. You guys ever done that? Like, man, this is so fun, and it's never going to see this guy again. And he like let me borrow his belt. And this is actually an analogy for what our relationship with God is like. I'm just going to use this. He gave me this belt, and I actually jacked it from him on accident. I went home with it. And this is like the nicest belt I've ever owned. I mean, literally, it's like legit. And I don't even know the guy's name. I literally don't even know the guy. I don't remember the guy's name. That's how I approach God. So here's an application for you. What's your belt? What's your belt? All right? I'm going to start there. Turn, if you have them, to your Bibles. That was all by way of introduction. To 2 Timothy chapter 3. I'm going to focus primarily on verse 5, which says this. And I chose this passage for a reason, because I think it's easy to misunderstand. Chapter 3, verse 5. Lovers of pleasure, and I'm going to start in verse 4, sorry, the second half of verse 4. Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having the appearance of godliness but denying its power. Avoid such people. What's the main translation here? NIV. Go ahead, come on. NIV? What's the NIV say for that last verse? Avoid such people. Have nothing to do with such people. Turn to your neighbor saying, have nothing to do with such people. Now turn to your other neighbor, who you're less comfortable with, and say, have nothing to do with such people. Now, this text is really easy to confuse and misunderstand because it sounds like what it's saying is you shouldn't care about joy and happiness and pleasure. You should care about God. But here's something that I think is unfallibly true, and I will overstate this probably because I don't believe it's possible to overstate it. Everybody is seeking happiness in every moment of their life. Everybody is seeking happiness, pleasure, joy. And God says, that's good. I made you for that because my glory is the best thing. The problem is where we find that pleasure. That makes sense? And this verse in particular is, like, 2 Timothy is written to overcorrect, not overcorrect, but to correct an error in Ephesus. And I think, obviously, the point stands. There is types of pleasures that we shouldn't seek, right? And he gives a list of them, in fact. We'll talk about that. But I don't, it's easy to misunderstand this. And in fact, I think this is part of the reason why it's easy to do what John Piper says, say dozens of true and wonderful things about the gospel and not lead people to where the gospel is leading. Because at the end of the day, the gospel is leading to God is glorious. He is beautiful. He is heavy. And it's appealing to your desire for joy. Do you like that? You like joy? You like pleasure? You like heaviness? You like just going there? Come on. Come on, that's what God's doing. That's where God's leading you. That's what heaven is. If that doesn't excite you, then you're not going to want to be in heaven. So, we're going to talk about that verse primarily. So, this is my question from that text. What is this? Having the appearance of godliness in verse 5, but denying its power. So, there is a power there. What is the power of godliness? And there's a few different ways to answer this question. First of all, I think is the more traditional, religious, conservative, maybe you might use that word, perspective on this question. And it says that this is the power of godliness, to bring out moral conformity, to bring about a homogeneously moral culture. And if you're not doing that, you got no power. Okay? More of a progressive or liberal way of answering this question is to say, the power of godliness is this. It's to resist oppression and injustice systemically and in culture and these sorts of things. All right? Both of those things are good things, by the way. I believe both of them are good. But I believe that both of those things can miss the decisive power of godliness, and that is this. The ability to see God's glory, which is there. It's in nature, it's in the church, it's in the word, it's in your neighbor in some ways. It's in having red hair, and it's in having brown hair, it's in having no hair. It's there. And to be 100% satisfied. That is the thing. That is the power of godliness. Turn to your neighbor and say, that is the power of godliness. All right, so we're going to walk. What I'm going to do is I'm going to walk through the text, and I'm going to give you some points, some interpretive points, and then I'm going to give you some application at the end. Does that sound good? That sound good? Good. Because the Bible's true, right? That's right. And some of us are like, man, the Bible's not relevant, and there's no, like, I prefer topical preaching. It's like, I've always been like, but every Bible verse has a topic. You like topical preaching? Preach the Bible well. You know? Anyway, verse 1 here. Let's start. But understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty. Can we be satisfied in times of difficulty? Can you? Can I? If it's God's love that you love primarily, when difficulty comes, it will be much harder, not impossible, but much harder for you to look God in the eye and say, you're still good. Because what you love about God is that he makes you feel good about himself, yourself. What you love about God is that he loves you. So when bad stuff happens to you, every time it's going to be a significant challenge. It's going to be a significant hurdle for you believing the main thing about God that brings power in your life. Whereas if the glory of God is that, then you know what? The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. When he takes stuff away, it is an opportunity for us to be weaned off of our addictions to other things, our consumptions of other things, how we consume TV and ministry and marriages and friendship and pornography and we consume everything, but we don't consume God. Consume God. I experienced this in my life. I was in a car accident in college. And I was a jock in high school. I was a thespian as well. So thespian to the jocks, jock to the thespians. All right, that's funny to one person. That's good. And in college, I had this significant accident, got some scars, check that out. And I really had a lot of, like I said, my identity stuff challenged. First when I went to college and then through this accident. But what I was able to do is I was able to be a real champ about it. If any of you guys knew me at the time, I was like getting on Facebook and like putting the gospel there and preaching the gospel all the time and like being really like a hero about it. Like I had my moments, I did. Like my mom knows, ask her, you know, Jeff knows. But like for the most part, I was like, you know what, I'm not going to waste my suffering. And the reason I think I could do that is probably the same reason a lot of you guys can do that is because what happened is it got at some of my identity stuff, but not my deep identity stuff. Because at that time in my life, and I would say still to this day, a lot of my identity comes out of my ability with words and with ideas and with persuasion and with philosophy and with theology. And at the time, I had my accident and I looked and I was like, I'm not going to die. My head's intact. I'm like, I'm good. You know, like I might have my leg cut off. Like I was looking, I was like, that's disgusting. But my deep identity stuff was not challenged. Now, later on in my life, and I would say even in this season of my life in some ways, I've had those deep identity stuff challenged. For example, when I gave my senior seminar thesis and my professor publicly shamed me in front of the class because I didn't dialogue with extra biblical Greek sources. That was tough. And what happened is, oh man, I could not get over that. It was in there and I was like, God, how dare you? How dare you put this in front of my life? I've given my life to you. You love me, God, don't you? In fact, I love that you love me. But what I had a hard time getting in touch with was that God was glorious, primarily. And that's what... So I have an illustration. Mona Lisa, you guys know the Mona Lisa? Raise your hand if you know the Mona Lisa. All right, everybody. That means this illustration is going to be the bomb. Right, really powerful picture in Western culture. Imagine it was the apocalypse, right? Like this text is describing. In the last days, there will come times of difficulty. And everyone's dead, except for you and the Mona Lisa. Everything else it's kind of silly, but you and the Mona Lisa are hanging out, right? And you've been a person your whole life, you love the Mona Lisa. You've been one of those weird people who are like really obsessed with the painting in a weird way. It's like, it's not that great of a painting, but it's like, oh, but the smile and okay. And then imagine like you run out of food and you're going to die. You're going to die. Everything's over. Do you burn the Mona Lisa before you die? I'm honestly interested. Do you? I like a little dialogue. Come on, guys. Some of us might. If the thing that we like about Mona Lisa is that Mona Lisa is smiling at us. It's like our relationship with God. Do you have categories for dying to yourself, to everything, and yet God remaining beautiful, regardless of whether you're there? So it's an imperfect analogy, but all right, let's go on with the text. Verse 2, all analogies are imperfect, by the way, so except the one Jay comes up with. Verse 2, for people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, this is ESV, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without control, self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, and swollen with conceit. Everybody say, wow. That's not, and some of you are like, that's like, look around, that's today, right? Good point. But I want to note something here. This is a culture of evil. The reason this list is long and really intense is because what Paul's trying to do is to give you a vivid sense of the fact that it was pervasive. Like in the book of Judges, everybody did what was right in their own eyes all the time without exception. So, we need to be careful when we start going, yeah, look at our culture. Our culture is this way. That's true. But I want you to realize that we are all a part of our culture. You're a part of this. I'm a part of this. In fact, we live in a day and age where culture is extremely invasive. Would you agree with that? Right? Everybody's got a TV in their home. And Twitter and Facebook. And like, there's no getting away from it. You might say, like, I'm not like that. But yes, you are. Whether you know, like, maybe not up here. Like, in this, but in this, you are. I want to give you an example of this. Love my family. They're here. Hopefully this, I praise them. I bless them. I honor them. I'm so thankful. I'm going to say one thing. Hopefully this isn't negative. I don't think it is. But when I got married, I realized that I was not like my wife. I thought I was in a lot of ways. I'm like, man, we have so much unity, ministry, and theology, and creativity, and stuff. but what I realized is that there were some things deep in me, right? There was a culture that I had come from that I was not aware of. And I thought I was pretty great when I got married. You know what I'm saying? I thought I was pretty great. But what happened is when we started like having conflict, I realized that I have learned patterns of conflict style that I thought were pretty good, but really led to a lot of frustration in my wife and in my marriage. Namely, like, I think out of a desire to protect me, my parents mostly didn't have conflict in front of me. And that was a good thing. But what it did is it kind of made me be very cold and rational and withdraw in conflict. And that was really hard for my wife. Anyway, the point I'm making is this. We're all a part of a culture. Family, broader culture. And so when we think we're exception to this list, I want you to be careful. I want you to be careful. Moving on. Here's the key text. Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Having the appearance of godliness, but denying its power. Avoid such people. So, I think there's a transition that happens in this text at this point. Because there's this long list of stuff that's really bad, right? Really bad? Would you say that? Yeah, I would say so too. But then, in this part of the text, it says, have an appearance of godliness. Would you say that someone who is unholy has an appearance of godliness? No, I wouldn't. So I believe what's happened is there's a transition that's happened. And he's addressing something more specific in the book of in the church of Ephesus, okay? That's what I believe, and I'm preaching. So if you want to believe something else, you preach. Start a small group, and you can have your own exegetical argument. The Greek in this portion is interesting. It's not that interesting, but it's interesting. A lot of people say, like, what does it say in the Greek? Well, it says what it says in the English, you know. But in this case, I do think there's an interpretive kind of thing. And I think, like I said, I think what's going on in this passage is that there's an overcorrection going on. And I think that when we translate it lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, it misses something. It misses something. So what I'm going to suggest is a different translation. Different translation. Not lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, but lovers of love. Rather than lovers of God. Everybody say lovers of love. Are you a lover of love? No, of course not. Here's an illustration. When I was in high school, my favorite band was a ska band, and I didn't like them at first. What I liked was that other people liked them. Does that make sense? My brother actually suggested them to me. That it's called Five Iron Frenzy. Five Iron Frenzy. Yeah, anybody? Some of you old OGs around here, original gangsters, you guys remember. Some of you youth group guys. And what happened is I didn't like them at first, but I think every taste really worth having is an acquired taste. Because God is an acquired taste in some ways. And Five Iron Frenzy was the same way. Like, you start listening to them, like, these guys are weird. Like, ska music? Who does that anymore? But then I started listening to some of the musicianship behind the songs, and I heard the complexity of the parts and all the different brass instruments, and then I started to hear the narrative of these guys and how compelling it was. And then after that, I started to hear references to literature in their lyrics, like The Sun Also Rises and these sorts of things. Like, I was like, wow, this is really good stuff. So the point that I'm making is this. We have to have categories for loving God in that way. Him being an acquired taste. All right, moving on. Verse 5. Having the appearance of godliness, but denying its power. Avoid such people. 4. Among them are those who creep into households and capture weak women. burdened with sins and led astray by various passions. Am I having issues? Am I? Somebody tell me. Is it the battery? All right, that's my problem then. I'll get better. It's not supposed to be funny. For among them are those who creep into households and capture weak women, burdened with sins and led astray by various passions, always learning but never able to arrive at a knowledge of the truth. Pastor Jay mentioned this church that we planted downtown in Mount View. And one thing that I've really liked about being part of this church is we was originally planted out of you guys. So thank you, by the way. And then we eventually called the guy who became a part of the Acts 29 network. And one of the great things about the Acts 29 network is that they really understand the importance of discipline. They understand that there are people who are going to come up on your door and knock on that door and hope that your wife answers the door so that they can sell her what they're selling, or they can take advantage of her because they know that she's burdened by kids like that. There are people like that. Do you guys know that? Avoid such people. These are the people who are always wanting a chance to teach. They always want power, but they refuse God's power. These people who are always wanting to get other people into submission of their authority, but they don't submit to authority. These are people who are all about coming to church and using church, but not themselves having a local church. It's like, is this your church? And if it is, are you in submission? Right? There are people like that, and he's addressing them here in the church. And he says that these people are this. Look at verse 7. They're always learning, but never able to arrive at the knowledge of the truth. They're floating around from small group to small group, from maybe marriage to marriage, from church to church, from ministry to ministry, and they're never arriving. There is a destination to the gospel. Do you get that? It's not about learning and learning and learning and learning. Who's been to the Grand Canyon? Yeah? You don't drive to the Grand Canyon for the road trip. Do you? You don't drive to the Grand Canyon to make yourself feel good about yourself. Some people do. Right? They get there, like, I don't give a rip about this, drive home, and they're like, hey guys, guess where I went? And they're like, oh, you're cool. That is whack. That's whack. And a lot of us treat God that way. A lot of us treat God that way, and there are specific people who treat God that way. Usually they're men, because men are proud, and they're chumps, and many of them are cowards, generally, as a rule. In fact, here's two men. Let's look on. Let's look on. Paul mentions them. Should I give up on this thing? Oh, man, all right. Really have to lean over for this. It'll pick me up? Okay. All right. Paul mentions two specific people in this text. Let's go on. Just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, so these men also oppose the truth. Men corrupted in mind and disqualified regarding the faith. But they will not get very far, for their folly will be plain to all, as was that of those two men. He names names! Like, these are historical names, so what Paul is doing is he's throwing out, like, hey, he's like basically saying, like, there are people amongst you like Hitler. That's what he's doing. And they're like, oh, really? Yes, they're there. But in other places, actually, I think in 2 Timothy 2, he names contemporary names. Do you have categories for that? If Jay got up here and starts saying, like, this guy who you know in Cedar Rapids is a wolf. You know what I mean by wolf? Shepherding, right? Shepherding. You got to be someone's sheep. Right? And there's not just sheep, there are wolves. And wolves eat sheep. And what do you do with wolves? You don't try and make them sheep. You shoot them. And that's what is going on here, right? Like, sometimes in ministry, we got to just go air war. We just got to magnify the excellencies of the bride of Christ and of Jesus himself. And sometimes we got to get out our sniper rifles. You know what I'm saying? You got to start naming names. And I don't mean primarily by disciplining people. I also mean by disciplining ourselves. Christians, I think we're like this, right? We're really good at saying, hey, man, like, I'm a sinner. Everybody's bad, right? And you're like, oh, really? Like, what's the Lord teaching you? Oh, well, you know, I go to church. It's like, oh, okay, what sins are you battling with in church? Oh, well, you know, everyone's flawed. Yeah, I know that. Like, what's the Lord working on you? And this is how the Lord's working on me. Like, and then they start talking about football, right? Does that sound familiar? Our main way that we pull out the sniper rifle is by saying, these are my issues, getting in community with people and saying, help me. I have a problem. I need help. I need you. And you need to be aggressive with me. In Acts 20, well, we'll come to that later. So, the big point, there's power in God, and it is the glory of God, right? So, I have a few applications, and then I'm going to call it quits. First off, what is my main application from this text? If there's one thing that I want you to walk away with from this text, it's this. It's verse 5. Have categories in your mind for this. Avoid such people. Or how's the NIV say it? Have nothing to do with them. Do you have categories for that? Like, God is a God of love, right? But he loves himself primarily. And there are people who will distract you from that goal, that destination, the glory of God, the goodness of God, the beauty of God. All right, two practical ways. Okay, avoid such people, really? Bible? Jesus, he was all about hanging out with sinners. Like, is that really? Man. All right, let me get specific for you, because it's hard to take a blanket statement like that and be constructive. First off, doctrine. Doctrine. Define and defend your distinct beliefs. Define and defend your distinct beliefs. Many Christians, and InterVarsity has actually struggled with this, many people who are involved in ministry, when you ask them what it means to be a Christian, they actually don't know. They just don't know. In fact, take 1 minute, turn to your spouse or child or friend, and in two sentences, why don't you say to them what it means to be, what's the essential thing that it means to be a Christian? What is the thing that all Christians of all times, of all places affirm? What is that? Ready, set, go. A lot of mumbling going on in here. How'd you do? Maybe you did pretty well. I'll tell you the answer, by the way, because I have the mic. Again, I mean this. I've really wrestled with this. I believe it's two things. It's one, that Jesus is God. Historically, that doctrine is called the hypostatic union. He has two natures. He is God, and he's also fully human. He's fully human and fully divine. Secondly, it's the Trinity. God exists as three persons in one essence, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. All Christians of all times and all places have affirmed those two things. Did you know that? The reason it's important is because if you're having fellowship and you're growing in community and ministry with people who don't believe that, you're not growing towards God. You need to avoid such people directly by saying, okay, we start praying together, we start worshiping together, like, What do you believe about God? And you start talking to them about the fact that Jesus is God, and they're like, oh, well, I don't believe that. Avoid that person. Avoid them. Like, don't not have coffee with them, but don't share your heart with them. Don't marry them. Don't make them your best friend. All right? Secondly, Acts 20 says this. It's a sermon Paul writes to the church of Ephesus. And this thing is dripping with masculinity, by the way. You dudes, you got to read Acts 20. What does it say? It says this: I never shrunk back in the midst of hardship and persecution and suffering and resistance to do what? To preach to you the whole counsel of God. Not what your itching ears wanted to hear, not things that made you feel like you were loved, but things that made you feel like God was glorious and that he was complex and that he was excellent and that there were things about him that rubbed into you like fire, right? When we meet fire, It affects us. We don't affect it, right? You reach your hand out for a fire, what do? You pull back, right? And God reveals himself as a cloud in the Old Testament as well as a fire. But the purpose of the cloud was always to get people to the flame of God. The morning star, I love that song that we sang, the morning star. God is a flame. He presses into us. Sorry, that was distraction. Acts 20, he also says this. And behold, he says, fierce wolves will come in your midst. What? Wolves. Not just wolves, fierce wolves. Right? Like, not just people who eat lambs, but they, like, torture them and then eat them. Fierce wolves will come. So be on your guard. Now, why do I say that? This is why I say that. You need to resist. You need to avoid wolves. You need to avoid such people directly. No questions asked. And the main way you do that is identifying who your shepherd is. Who's your shepherd? And if he's your shepherd, is he really your shepherd? Are you really saying, I'm a sheep? I submit to you. Speak into my life. Correct me. Rebuke me. Offend me if you have to. Because if you're not a sheep, you're either a wolf. And if you're a man and you're not a sheep, you're probably a wolf. Or you're food for wolves. Those are the only three options. You're either a sheep, a wolf, or food for wolves. Which are you? All right? Avoid such people directly by defining doctrine. Secondly, by being in a flock and exercising discipline, being under discipline. Secondly, you need to indirectly avoid such people. And this is really where the heart of this lies. Because here's the deal. God doesn't care what you do at the end of the day. He cares about who you worship. He cares about who you worship. You need to value God's glory more than God's love. That's the only point of this message. Because otherwise, what will happen is what I call the avoidance drift. The text says avoid such people. You do this. We all do this. Right? Like, for those of you who are more religious people, like you do this by the nature of the small group you join, or the accountability group you join, or the Sunday school class you join, right? And if you're a more irreligious person, like, you do this. In fact, check this out. When I moved to Chicago, I really liked pop punk music. Like I said, MXPX and Slick Shoes and Sick of Change. And none of these are mainstream. You guys are like, what? But when I got to Chicago, all my friends and buddies really liked indie music. It was really coming up, you know, like, I had two options. Like, I really wanted to be friends with these people, so I could start focusing on them as people and saying, like, trying to, like, bring up allusions to their music in conversation, or I could just focus on the music and learn to acquire the taste of that music. Because otherwise what was going to happen is we were buddies at first because, you know, we all moved together. But eventually there would be an avoidance drift that would happen because we weren't into the same stuff. And this happens in your life. When you marry a person who's not a Christian, what it means to be a Christian is that the glory of God is at the center of your life. And what it means to be married is that you share the center of your life with someone forever. So if they don't have the glory of the God at the center of the life, what's going to happen? Either you're going to move the glory of God out of the center of your life so that you can share the center of your life with them, or they're going to share that, right? So, you need to learn to indirectly avoid such people in that way. You need to understand the avoidance drift. And then lastly, this is my last point. Don't just be infatuated with God. You need to be shocked by God. You have categories for that? I love the piano song. Joshua fit the battle of Jericho. Right? They were shocked. That's shocking what happened there. Do you have categories for that? Like, most contemporary Christian music is what I call, like, Jesus is my boyfriend music. Right? Or my girlfriend sometimes. Usually girlfriend, really, right? Like, Jesus has some product in his hair, and he's kind of like, you could probably beat him up, you know? I like to call them 7-11 songs, 7 words 11 times, over and over and over again. Like, the way we treat our boyfriend and girlfriend, like, man, they're really kind of screwed up, but if I just kind of keep focusing. You need to have some mighty fortresses, our God. You need to have some be thou my vision. You know what I'm saying? There's a political philosopher named Machiavelli, and he had something that he talked about called the shock and awe governance principle, where if a town that he was a prince over was really rebellious, he would show up and he would find whoever could be the scapegoat, the main insurrectionist, would bring them out and brutally publicly murder them. And what he saw is that would shape that culture, that would reverberate into that town for years. And it was very effective. Now, Machiavelli was a chump. I don't recommend him. But you need to have categories for God doing that. Imagine that your life is a little village under the prince's rule, Prince Jesus' rule. And imagine that there's rebellion, there are things coming up, and there's just tumultuous, and it's just like a raging storm. Do you have categories for God? You have categories for God showing up, finding the main sin that you have, getting out his sniper rifle, and putting it to that sin, and poof. Do you allow God to shock you? You need to, because that's going to move you toward the weightiness of God. Aslan from Chronicles of Narnia. There's a scene where the beavers are introducing Lucy, primarily, I think, is the main character who's asking these questions to Aslan. They're talking about Aslan, and Aslan is the lion. He's a figure of Jesus, and they're like really curious because I hear that Aslan is this great king and he's roaming and he's been gone and it's very mysterious. And they're like, wow, well, tell us about him. And they're starting to talk about him. They're saying, oh, Aslan, like, oh, you would just be amazed. You would just be shocked if you, and they're like, wow, he sounds kind of scary. Well, is he safe? And the beavers laugh. No, he's not safe. He's the king, but he's good. He's good. That's how Jesus is in our lives. Let's allow him to be that. Let's allow ourselves to be shocked by him. So let me pray. God, thank you for your word. Again, strike anything from the record that is not of you. And be with us as we close in worship. In Jesus' name, amen.